All right, everyone. Welcome back from lunch. I know some of you are still settling in, but we do want to get started on time for this next presentation and our next two speakers. So our next topic is understanding the connection between ACEs, resilience, and ADHD. I know many of you are very aware of ACEs and how adverse childhood experiences can shape the rest of a child and then young adult's life. So today we have two speakers that probably don't need a lot of introduction, but they are fabulous, and they're involved with a lot of initiatives that Maine Quality Counts does, and we love partnering with them. So first we have Dr. Steven Meister, who is the director of the Edmund Irvin Pediatric Center. And then we also have with us Sue Mackey Andrews, who is the co-founder of the Maine Resilience Building Network. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve, and here is the clicker. If you have any issues, let me know. And he's going to move around to keep you all awake after lunch.
Oh, good. Okay. So I do a program for children entering foster care. We've been doing it. This is our 20th year. Whenever a child in six counties in Maine comes into foster care, they see a child psychologist and they see a pediatrician, and we get all their medical and mental health and dental and educational records, and we make recommendations for their care. And when we looked at our data after a couple of years, we found that over 20% of the boys had been diagnosed with ADHD. These are teenage boys that were over 12. And so, we brought Dr. Felitti here to talk about adverse childhood experiences, and we feel like we've had 20 years of experience of seeing what children with attachment problems, who've had traumatic stress, and who have mental health challenges, neurobiological challenges, what they look like altogether, and what a challenge it is to try and help them and their families. So I think that's really what we're going to try and get to. And I have a case that is an amalgam of three kids that that are very strong in my memory, where we can look at diagnosing ADHD, treating ADHD, and then thinking about these other challenges. So let's see. Okay. When children are parents with mental illness and substance abuse, they experience problems with attachment. And that's not the same as when children experience severe traumatic stress that causes a sense of life threat and PTSD. And what the ACEs are and what that means for their long-term health and being, some children have ACEs, attachment, and trauma, and it's important to address all of these challenges. So there's a really wonderful pediatrician named Moira Szilagyi, and she was in Rochester for many years. She's now at UCLA, and she wrote a paper that I read in 1997 about caring the medical needs of kids entering foster care. And she and Mark Sims and Howard Dubowitz got together and wrote a paper in 2000, and they showed that most children enter foster care with medical, mental health, and developmental problems. Most don't get adequate or appropriate care while in the placement, and there are a lot of barriers to care. And that's why we developed our program. Most children are placed in foster care as a result of neglect. In this one study, 50% of the children had experienced neglect. Now, you have to remember, neglect is not that you didn't get your lunch today or you didn't get the toy that you wanted. Neglect is failure to protect or failure to provide necessities. So what do we mean by that? We mean a 7-year-old who comes downstairs and finds her mother and her mother's boyfriend passed out on the floor, except the boyfriend's dead, and the mother is had an overdose of fentanyl. And she calls 911, and they come to take the parent away and resuscitate the parent, and the girl comes into foster care. She's not in foster care because she was sexually abused or physically abused or emotionally abused. She's been neglected. So to me, this is powerful and pretty awful. Physical abuse, 26%, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and medical neglect. This is the critical piece. Only 10% of children for whom abuse or neglect is substantiated are removed from parental care. So lots of kids have these experiences. The kids who have the most severe experience are the ones who come into care. They're a very high-risk group of youth and children. Moira Szilagyi in 98, so this is the paper that I read, said that 80% had at least one chronic medical problem, 25% three or more chronic problems, 60% of children in foster care had a developmental disability, 40% of older children qualified for special education services. Children in foster care tend to be under-immunized, so our folks here from the Immunization Coalition know about this, even when compared with other poor children. In Maine, we're not allowed to immunize these kids when they come into care if their parents don't want them to be immunized, even though they're now in state care and the state's responsible. So what happens to them long term? So this is a British study. 13,000 kids in public, 13,000 children they looked at, 350 had been in public care. The kids in public care were twice as likely to be homeless as adults, 2.3 times more likely to have been convicted of a crime, more than twice as likely to be unemployed, twice as likely to have a psychiatric morbidity, and more likely to be in poor health. So as we go through this, we'll also be thinking about how ACEs plays a role in all of these. So here's the case. I go in this room, and this is a true case. And I walk in, and there's this little boy, and he's got his hat pulled over one eye. Can't see that eye, but I could see this eye, and he's peering at me. And he's shoved all the way up against the end of the exam table. And he's swinging his legs back and forth, and they're banging against the exam table. And I say, "Hi, what's your name?" And he says, "Nanya." I said, "Boy, that's a funny name. Well, what's your last name?" "Bidness, Nanya Bidness." And so, you know, this is a kid who's, you know, he's not happy about being there. He's got a chip on his shoulder, and he's scared. He's really scared. This is a first appointment with me, poor eye contact, one-word answers. He's in temporary care. Father's in jail, meth lab caught fire, and he blew up the house. Mother's been in and out of his life, and mother's in jail, has mental illness, substance abuse, threatening to hurt herself and others. And she recently went back to jail because of an OUI. And he's living with his maternal grandmother, who loves him, and his uncles. And they are the stabilizing force in his life. So he's aggressive at home and at school. He hits other kids. Sometimes he hits himself. I did a modified overt aggression scale score. I don't know if you guys ever do that. It's part of the ADHD toolkit that the AAP produced. He shouts, he threatens to hurt himself and others. He throws toys, he stomps his feet, he breaks things on purpose. He hits himself and he hits others. So he's got a scale score of like 25. He's really aggressive. It's really hard to be with him. And most kids, you know, that come to my office have a 4 or a 5. So when they get over 30, we're looking to, you know, for a psychiatric facility for a brief period of time. So he's really aggressive. Wants to be a robber when he grows up. This is another kid. My first question for him was, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" And he says, "A robber." Impulsive and distractible at home and school, difficult with sleep onset, nightmares, daytime headaches, secondary nocturnal enuresis, since the house caught fire, stomach aches and stool leakage, diarrhea alternating with constipation. You know, when I do the bowel clean out, oftentimes the parents will say, no, he doesn't need that because he has diarrhea all the time. But we know that that's constipation. 6 months in care, and he's dramatically better. Safe, stable home environment, now at his grandmother's. Sleep is improved, he does take melatonin. Nightmares are gone, he sleeps through the night. Headaches, abdominal pain have resolved. The enuresis and enkephresis are gone. It was not easy, it took a fair amount of work. I had to convince her, but we got him cleaned out. Now he's on you know, he's eating fiber bars, and he's eating a much better diet than he was eating before. Psych evaluation showed low cognitive function with a full-scale IQ of 74, and he has ADHD. And if you've got Vanderbilts, I think you have them in your packet, and I don't know if we put, did we put them on the, yeah. So if you look at the packet, and you look at the first Vanderbilt, you know, he's got threes, a lot of twos, a lot of ones. You know, it's not the worst case of ADHD I've ever seen. It's not all threes, but he's affected. So we started him on a low dose of stimulant. We gradually increased it. He started behavior therapy, and he's doing much better. If you look at the second Vanderbilt, he's now mostly zeros and ones. Has everybody got the Vanderbilt forms out? If you, it should be in your packet. So, and these are actual for this, for one of these boys. These are his Vanderbilt forms. So, and he is living with his grandmother. This little boy, he needs a lot of teacher support. But with a low dose of stimulant, he's moved from threes, twos, and ones to ones and zeros. And then if you flip to the next side, the third Vanderbilt form is all zeros. So I'm feeling like a hero, you know, average in everything except reading, math, and writing, but we know his cognitive scores are low, and he has some learning disabilities. So the school, we did the cognitive testing, the school is addressing this. He's, boy, this is great. Now he wants to be a cop, okay? He wants to protect people, you know? And now his name is Buddy. He wants me to call him Buddy. I mean, this is great. I got chills. I feel really good. Okay, so attachment. So what happened to this little boy? So his mom is in and out of his life. His dad was the one he was really attached to. And his dad blew the house up with a meth lab. He really, this is a true thing. And this kid came into me, and he doesn't trust anybody except his grandmother. And now he's living with his grandmother, and he's got a, and he feels safe. And his uncles have stepped in, and I talked to the family and got them to step up, and they've become his father. He doesn't need big brother, because we had talked about that. He's got the uncles, and they go to ball games. They do everything together. So, you know, this is like 101 Harlow in 1958, where I learned about this in college. You know, he did the rhesus monkeys in contact comfort. He had a wire cage. And they took that poor rhesus monkey and they put it on a wire cage, and it had bizarre behavior. It bit itself, it bit everybody else, it soiled all over the place. They put another one, another baby rhesus monkey with a carpet on the wire cage, and that contact comfort just from the carpet was a good enough, but good enough mothering for that baby monkey to be able to go back into the family and get mothered and become socialized. And the other monkey didn't do so well. So early, you know, attachment is really critical. Bowlby and others, children are pre-programmed to form attachments with others. Attachments were most likely to form with those who responded accurately to the baby's signals, not necessarily the person they spent more time with. So for this child, his father was really loving, even though he was, you know, dealing in methamphetamines. And his mother was really absent and cold and really hard for him. And she has serious mental illness. So attachment, affectional bonds, involves a specific person, persistent, emotionally significant. They wish to maintain proximity, distress upon separation, and the individual seeks comfort in the relationship as well as security. So this little boy has his grandmother, who he's now got a nice attachment with. Ainsworthy in the 1970s, the strange situation, that's a procedure where the mommy and the baby are in a room together, the stranger enters me to do an exam. mom leaves the baby alone, the stranger comes in, and then the mom returns. Securely attached babies are upset when mom departs, but calmed by mom's return, and they explore around the room. And anybody in here who's a provider who takes care of little children has done this, you know, and then you can see the children exploring the room after a period of time. There's the anxious, resistant babies. They have a hard time separating. The mom leaves, they get really upset. And when the mom comes back in, they really need a lot of soothing. Now, this isn't always because the baby's been neglected. There are, I've taken care of lots of children who have sort of genetic anxiety, and they also have terrible problems with this. And then there's the anxious avoidant. We see this in kids in foster care. Any pediatrician or other provider who's taking care of kids in foster care knows that there are situations where the child comes to me and wants to be with me and not with their provider. So that's more the anxious avoidant. They separate easily, they climb in my lap, they come around behind my desk, and they don't really want to have anything to do with the other person. They don't really have a very good attachment to that person. Then there's the really difficult one, and if anybody knows about Charlie Zena, he's a researcher who's done a lot of work in attachment, and he's got this great video of a child with disorganized attachment. The child is with the DHS caseworker, and the mother who has mental illness and substance abuse, and this child is climbing all over the place. And he's hitting himself, and he's really disorganized in his behavior, and he's behaving a lot like that rhesus monkey who had the wire cage. And then the next video is the child with the grandmother with whom he has a good attachment. And he's settled, and he's saying, "Thank you, Grandma," and he sits, and you say, "Holy cow, this is a completely different child." So in that first case, you, if you're in the office and you see that, you're gonna say, "Well, ADHD, I'm giving him stimulants because holy cow, how can you take care of this kid?" When this is really a problem of disorganized attachment. Securely attached children have more positive affect, more symbolic play, at 3.5 years, more social competence, greater sympathy, and less withdrawal. So that's attachment. So now we're going to quickly jump into traumatic stress. So what makes something traumatic is an event occurs or a series of events occur that are not predictable. I'm going to go to children are situational. And we see this with kids who end up in psychiatric hospitals. And I have kids who do this all the time. So they're in their home, a boy with autism is in his home, and his mother's boyfriend beats her up. And he goes ballistic, this boy. And he's tantruming, he goes to school, he can't be in school. We don't know about the domestic violence. What we know is he can't be in school, he does not want to go back to that home. They try to take him back to that home, and he's hitting everybody. So he has to go to the ER. He's now totally enraged, and he's hitting everybody in the ER. He goes to Spring Harbor, and after a day, he's totally settled, totally calm. He's in his, doing his program. They didn't change his meds at all. We didn't know what had happened, but clearly something had happened. They came to discharge him, and his mom came with her boyfriend, and he goes ballistic, because he doesn't want to go back to that place. So he's in a safe environment. It's not like this is a mental illness. This is a reaction to his sense of threat. So what events lead to traumatic stress? Ones that change beliefs about the world as a safe place. They create a sense of vulnerability. There's a real life threat. The child or parent may feel helpless. So, teenage boy, and this is a horrible story, and I apologize, but this is a true story. Teenage boy, 17 years old, he's in my pediatric practice, and he's driving home. It's the winter, and he's following his girlfriend. He passes his girlfriend, and he's driving ahead. And a moose goes in the highway. This is between Waterville and Augusta, and this is a long time ago, so I can tell this story. And so he swerves out of the way. And she hits the moose.
Oh.
Right. And the moose comes on the top of the car, and it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. So he gets out of the car, he goes back, he sees her. Okay, sense of life threat. Helpless. Uncertainty about the outcome, except he was certain because she was dead. There can be pain or observed pain. There were other kids in her car. They were injured. Exposure to injury or death of others. And, you know, the family oftentimes is required to make important decisions in times of great distress. So a mom is driving home and she flips her van. The kids are in the car seats. It's that snow after the ice, so there's black ice. She hits, she skids, the car rolls. Nobody's hurt. She's fine. She will not drive. She will not drive, and so dad has to drive the kids to school. Dad's late for work. Dad's being threatened that he's going to lose his job. So mom and dad start fighting. Now this boy, their son, can't sleep. And he starts wetting the bed. So why do they come in? He's wetting the bed. That's why they came in. So I work my way back through, and I understand she has PTSD. She's having nightmares. She will not go near where that accident happened. And that's why that was his experience of traumatic stress. Traumatic stress symptoms. It pops into my mind, feels like it's happening again, so they re-experience. I try to block it out, not think about it. I try to stay away from things that remind me of it. I'm always afraid something bad will happen. I jump at any loud noise. I can't concentrate, can't sleep. I can't even remember parts of it. So these and other emotional reactions are common in children and family after traumatic stress. So let's go back to that 7-year-old who came down the stairs and found her mom in a coma and her mom's boyfriend dead. She came into my office, not able to sleep at night, having nightmares, re-experiencing, soiling her pants. These are all the symptoms of traumatic stress that we see. And she can't concentrate at school. She can't barely go to school. She's not learning. And kids comes walking down the hall, and she whacks a kid just because she thought he was going to do something to her. So she's highly stimulated. We have acute stress disorders and post-traumatic stress. Acute stress is, they may be dissociative, re-experience. Kids and dissociation can be very hard to identify. And that's why we have a child psychologist on the team as well, because they sometimes are better at identifying those things than I am. It's good to work in teams, I think. Everyone has sad looks in their faces, and I feel really badly. But this is what we talk about when we're talking about traumatic stress. We're not talking about, you know, you didn't get what you wanted. The symptoms for post-traumatic stress disorder last at least a month. They have an exaggerated startle response and increased arousal. For acute stress, symptoms last, you know, 2 days to 4 weeks, but cause impairment. Most people are resistant. They're resilient. They don't get post-traumatic stress disorder. In a study of kids with cancer, they looked at their moms, and only 45% of the moms developed PTSD. 25% of the dads developed PTSD unless you gave them tasks. And if you gave them things to do, it dropped down to like 5%. So men are more resistant to PTSD when bad things happen in the family if you give them tasks and you involve them. If you exclude them and they're not involved, they feel horrible guilt and they do much worse. The only thing that helped the mothers was that the kids were cured of the cancer. And siblings, some of the siblings will develop PTSD, but more than half of the moms did not develop PTSD. So what happens? So you get a sudden adrenaline release. You get increased urine production, and that's because adrenaline blocks antidiuretic hormone. And so you make more pee. And so there's an increased risk that they'll wet themselves in the day or at night. There's hypervigilance and poor sleep, again, because they've got all this adrenaline on board. They're jumpy, reactive, increased startle response, and blood is shunted from their GI system to their muscles. You know, to move your bowels, you have to turn on the parasympathetic system. That means you have to turn off the sympathetic system. If your sympathetic system is on all the time, it's hard to digest your food. So it's hard to move your bowels. So these kids get constipated, and they get stomach aches. They have a reason to have the stomach ache. It's not just that they're, you know, emotional. They really got a stomach ache because they got to go to the bathroom, and they can't. So think about these challenges. They're aggressive. They have jumpy, reactive behavior. They see threats that aren't there. Sleep deprivation, nightmares, attend to the threat and not schoolwork, poor school performance, and increased injuries. Boy, this overlaps with ADHD in a lot of ways. So I put in everybody's packet a little booklet that is done by the AAP and a woman named Heather Forque. And Heather also sees a lot of kids entering foster care. And it's called Helping Foster and Adoptive Families Cope with Trauma. And it's really nice because it looks at a lot of these symptoms, okay? So, okay, back to Buddy. Now he's 8. 12 months in care, safe, stable home environment, now at GM's. See the fourth Vanderbilt. 1, 2, 3, 4. Still really good. Oh, he's got a few more symptoms. But, you know, nothing that I'm going to do anything about. But there's a little bit of symptoms. Vanderbilt in November was excellent. School reports are great. And now, flip to the last one, the fifth one, and it looks like the first one again. So you might be tempted to say, he's gained a lot of weight, he's bigger, we'll just increase his stimulant. But then you ask these other questions, you know, oh, can't go to sleep until midnight. He just came in, this kid was just actually in my office a couple of weeks ago. Not able to sleep till midnight, up at 6 for school. He's 8, he's sleeping 6 hours. Inattention worse, impulsive, not completing his work, needs the teacher's time again, unhappy and distracted when the teacher leaves the room. So who can guess what's happened? Mom is out of jail. And mom has been calling him and saying, I'm taking you back from grandma, because grandma doesn't have legal guardianship, because they just put him with grandma. And so this could really happen. So grandma is mad. She came into my office. She's really mad. She's mad at me. I told her that she needed to get a lawyer. She needed to get guardianship. You know, we got a case manager. She didn't want to do that. It's her daughter. Boy, these are really hard. And the young woman is back in her house. And out of her house and back in her house, and she's drinking, and oh my God, it's a mess. It's a complete mess. So what do you do? So he's going back into therapy with Dick Watson, who did a great job with him before, and I look at John because John knows Dick, and Dick does a great job. He does DBT with adults who have substance abuse issues, and I'm hoping that maybe we can get mom into Dick's group. We have a program that it's called the Maine Enhanced Parenting Program, and Amy wanted me to talk about that a little bit, and it's a mix of the intensive outpatient program for adults with mental illness and substance abuse, and they also have to do triple P or they don't get their kids back. And the state is doing this, and it's an effective program, and we've got it going in the Lewiston Auburn area, we've got it going in Skowhegan, in Augusta and Waterville, and on the coast. It's also up in the Bangor area, and it's down the southern part of the state. But it's really, we need more triple P. We need more of these programs. We don't have enough. And we'll see. And I increased the stimulant a little bit because he's inattentive. And grandma was really mad at me and said, it's just going to mask his symptoms. And I said, no, it might just make him pay attention better at school. And he needed melatonin again. And I said, because he can't sleep. So, you know, so understanding that, you know, this is this mix of neurobiology and environment and development, you know, attachment. He's really, his attachment with his grandmother is now threatened. So some of our data. So we looked at 1,000 kids over 7 years, infants, children age 2 to 5, children 6 to 11, teens 12 to 17. We found, these are our kids entering foster care, I should say. So we had 1,000 kids over 7 years come into foster care through our program. And I'm pointing out the diagnoses that we had. So for the kids age 12 to 17, 30% of the girls had PTSD and 23% of the boys. It turns out girls are more likely to get PTSD than boys. ADHD, 6% of the girls, 26% of the boys. You know, I saw almost all of these kids, and most of them really do have ADHD. They have what my coworker, Sean Kalbeck, who's a child psychologist, says, yes. Do they have trauma? Yes. Do they have ADHD? Yes. You know, so they can have more than one thing, especially when they're in, and they may be more sensitive to these life experiences than other kids. Depression, 24% of the girls, 12% of the boys. These kids are really affected. So we this exam too should be over here. We see them back in our program about 10 months later. And you can see at exam one, 88% of the 15 to 17-year-olds met the criteria for a mental health diagnosis. This is an entry to foster care. And 10 months later, 67%. So when people tell me that foster care is bad and it harms kids, I think about this data. Can it be harmful? Yes. You know, are there some kids who experience attachment problems? Yes. But these kids, the 10 to 14-year-olds, 80%. The 5 to 9-year-olds, 80% had mental health problems. And if you go 10 months later, after being in a safe, stable, nurturing environment, it's 60%. Children with first placement in an agency setting were more than twice as likely to have placement instability. What does that mean? If we put you in a residential place and not a home, you were more likely to have multiple placements. 25% of the children had 3 or more placements in a year. 40% of the teenagers had 3 or more placements in a year. The more placements you have, the more likely you'll have PTSD, the worse your outcomes. And in our state, so this is our state, so we showed initially other states. So in our state, 90% of the kids had experienced neglect, 64% exposed to domestic violence, so now we're getting towards the ACEs, 45% physical abuse, 30% sexual abuse, teenage girls, 20% of the teenage boys had been sexually abused. My wife was shocked. That was the one that upset her the most of this. 10% of the teenagers had had a parent death, and 35% had had 4 or more adverse childhood experiences. Quick on PrEP and foster care and ACEs. So you know about ACEs, and Sue, you're going to talk about the ACEs. That's the 65% with domestic violence, a lot of kids exposed to substance abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. So we looked recently, in 2015, so we looked at kids from July 2014 to December 2015, and we found that 74-75% had been exposed to substance abuse. I'm going to go back. So in 2005, 65% had been exposed to substance abuse. So we have more substance abuse now than we did. For the little kids, about 1 out of 4 under age 2 had been diagnosed with neonatal abstinence syndrome, so 25%. So we need to figure out what to do with that. And in 1999 to 2005, we had 35 infants a year coming into care in our program. And now we have 56 infants a year coming into our program. And that's all drug-affected babies. And we know that that's going to affect attachment. We know that that's going to lead to more trauma. And we know that parents smoke. If mom smokes during the pregnancy, that increases the risk of ADHD. And most of these moms who are involved with substances also smoke cigarettes. Mom out of jail in February 2018. Police have already been to mom's home twice. The boy has been exposed to threatening and substance abuse. She's been screaming at her mother, threatening to kill her. Mom was upset when they didn't want to come for Easter after the police had come because she had threatened to kill her mother, and the neighbors called the police. He's afraid mom will harm the grandmother, worried about his mother, and he blames himself. He blames himself because he had mom's phone, and he did something to the phone, and mom said, "You ruined my phone." She threw the phone against the wall, and that's what precipitated the tantrum that she had. And so he's sure that it's his fault that his mom's going to go back to jail and that, or that his mom will harm his grandmother. ADHD and LD, attachment and traumatic stress. Okay. ACEs, exposed to domestic violence, emotional abuse, exposed to parental substance abuse, exposed to parental mental illness, parent incarcerated, parent neglect. She passed out on the bed midday when she was supposed to take him back to school, so he stayed at home watching cartoons all day. Because she was stoned. That she is not the devil. She's actually a lovely person. You know, she came into the office once. We met her. She's really a very nice, sweet person. But she has a problem with mental illness and substance abuse. Okay. Sue?
So we're going to make a little bit of a transition. But yes, I do. Thank you. One of the things I wanted to piggyback with some stuff that Steve just said is the new epidemic population in our state are who we call grand families. We estimate that there are between 14 and 16,000 of these grand families throughout the state. The average age when they assume care of a child is 61. And Steve just reminded you how many infants are coming into care now. Used to be, when I was in the field, the middle-level kids were the highest population entering into the child welfare system. Now it's babies. Now it's children under the age of five, largely for neglect. So they're getting these little guys. They still have, as Steve said, they have no legal rights to these children. They often choose not to pursue them. But even if they did, it would be an impossible case because these folks have bypass the child welfare system. They get these calls on a Thursday or Friday. If you don't come and get Charlie, he's going to go to New Hampshire because we don't have any foster care homes. So they go take these kids, or they precipitously take these kids. So what do they have when they're in their early 70s now? A teenager. So I'm almost 70. The thought of having a teenager is not in my bucket list, you know? And I can guarantee you when I was 61, the thought of having a four-year-old was still not on my bucket list, right? Yeah. So we're choosing now at the Maine Resilience Building Network to really look at the pair of ACEs, not just the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, which really looked at three different kinds of ACEs, child abuse, child neglect, and household trauma. But we're looking now at also adverse community effects. Because this is really the whole package that we're looking at young children. So we can have children living in absolutely wonderful family home environments, but coming to school and being bullied. Or in our increase in LGBT students, being marginalized or treated poorly in school. So for a variety of things can happen in the community. They can be living in a dangerous neighborhood. They can be homeless. The largest growing homeless population in Maine are young mothers with very young children. So it's a substantial change in terms of what some of us have been used to before. So really looking at the pair of ACEs, what's happening in the home, but also what's happening outside the home. And when we take this approach, I have to tell you, when we train community groups of people, it's much easier for parents and grandparents to hear that this is more of a collective experience of children, not just what happens behind the front door. So I just would add that for you. So thinking about the response issues, issues of stress. So we all go through stress every day. Normal stress is good. It helps us to get up in the morning and go to work and try new things, be able to succeed, be able to fail, be able to get up and start all over again. This is essential for young children and for us as adults. The kind of tolerable stress, so I think of my friends in Puerto Rico right now who still don't have water and electricity and adequate food. But in Puerto Rico and elsewhere where we've had natural emergencies, there's somebody with these children, with these other adults, holding their hand and saying, don't worry, sweetie, it's going to be okay. I'm going to be here with you. So there is a buffer. There is a caring adult who's with this child protecting them. Because remember, if you remember nothing from what I say today, all children want to be loved. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But they want to be safe. They need to be safe more. And so some of the things we're seeing now are children's natural desire to be safe. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. The kind of stress that we're talking about now, toxic stress, are those repeated, prolonged, unanticipated events that happen to kids. The domestic violence, the child abuse and neglect, being exposed to substance. And while we are all focused on the opiate crisis, what is the greatest drug crisis in the state of Maine? Alcohol. And if you've ever worked with a child with fetal alcohol, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a devastating thing to watch with young children. The difference in toxic stress is that there's no buffer. There's nobody there saying, don't worry, sweetie, I'm going to be right here with you. And often the person who's perpetrating the toxic stress is who? The person who should be taking care of them. So it's a double whammy for these kids, a very double whammy. And this stuff can start during the prenatal period because we know that fetus is being bathed in mom's cortisol. So if she's a mom living in a homeless situation or domestic violence, her cortisol levels have gone up, creating a sense of change for that infant in their really prime development of brain development during the first 3 years plus the prenatal period. And what we have are kids who are coming out with exaggerated amygdala, so that's your emotional center in your brain. So they have a highly emotional reactive response and a depressed or smaller than normal hippocampus. And hippocampus is your memory center. It's the place in your brain that helps you to get yourself composed to manage or regulate your behavior. So we have a lot of kids who are highly emotional but lack the cognitive ability to self-regulate, to manage their own actions and behaviors. And so this is a PET scan of the anxiety brain. And when I go to schools, we've been increasing our work with public schools significantly lately. I can tell you that in the early grades, so pre-K, kindergarten, up to third grade, as well as in early care settings, the majority of teachers are telling me that about 50%, 30 to 50% of the kids who are coming in these early grades have hyperanxiety. They can't sit still. They don't know how to behave. They don't know how to function with normally developing peers. And they spend most of their day chasing after children rather than doing academic instruction. It's pretty serious. And the long-term effects, as Steve was saying, you know, belly aches, headaches, lots of somatic issues, lots of behavioral issues. They get sick a lot. They can't sleep. Important things for us to know about as we work with families. And the earlier that this stuff happens, the potential, not the reality, but the potential for there to be long-term negative outcomes for these children is significant. So we've done, Steve and I have had some really good conversations about PTSD versus ADHD. Because what we're seeing are a lot of medicated kids in school. But also what the teachers are telling us is, boy, they're like PTSD kids. When I read about PTSD, they look like PTSD. Schools increasingly are identifying these kids under other health impaired simply to get them services. They don't know what's going on with them, but they want to give them whatever they can at this moment in time. So we're seeing a lot of those things that Steve talked about, including developmental regression, lots of behavior problems, detachment. One of the things, as Steve was talking, I worry, you know, we have the teachers who will describe these kids, and I know we have some school nurses in the room here today. So these are the table jumpers, the runners, and the biters. I worry equally, if not more, about the kid, as I saw in one school recently, who was in a fetal position under the teacher's desk while they were having circle time. There's something wrong there, right? But we often miss those kids. I've had teachers talk to me about, you know, I'm driving home the other day, and I couldn't remember if Charlie was in class or not, because Charlie is often hiding in the corner, quiet. So we need to think about all of these kids. So we've brought to some of this work the social emotional learning and development study that was produced with the Maine Children's Growth Council with significant leadership from the Maine Children's Alliance. And Claire is here with us today. And this came from a lot of conversations at the Children's Growth Council about all of these teacher reports, early care, early public school, with kids really demonstrating significant behavioral disruption. Stories about ed techs in schools being hurt by kids, workman's comp claims in some of the programs going out of the roof because these kids are so violent. This is a concern. So we, through the Alliance support, got some professionals to come and help us look at this issue, survey a whole lot of people in early care and public school. And we learned a lot. We learned that Maine is second in the country for suspension and expulsion of very young children from early care settings. Second in the country. Right? And this, we turned this into LD 1108, which has passed the legislature and now is waiting for funding, and we're hoping to hear over the next couple of weeks. But this would allow early childhood consultation services to programs working with very young children and kids in the early grades to come in and really work with the child, the family, and the teacher to do some environmental and some behavioral changes to help these kids self-regulate and learn how to manage themselves better. And I know that many of you are seeing these kids and you're working with schools. And so this is really why this is so important, because your leadership and your advice to schools is really pivotal to help them figure out, in partnership with you, what are the important things to do with these kids. So some of the things that we learned were that more than 50% of the teachers reported that they were having serious problems with kids in their classroom, with hitting, throwing, extremely active or impulsive behaviors, not cooperating with normal school tasks, or being very sad, withdrawn, and not participating. So when we look at the ACEs study, some of the data that we know, so we're starting from the pretty high level, are that kids with three or more ACEs tend to have really significant challenges in school. They tend to often end up in special education. They're suspended or expelled more frequently than other kids. And they tend to drop out of school more frequently than other children. And so when we think about some of the things that we're seeing in Maine and our society today, just thinking about how is adverse childhood experiences or the adverse community experiences affecting kids, we see the higher the score of ACEs, the greater problems with families, divorce, family relationships, etc., higher levels of financial instability, higher levels of unemployment. I don't know what it's doing now. Higher levels of incarceration, exposure to drugs. And these kids often move multiple times during the year. So thinking about a lot of the things that we're seeing with kids now. Okay, thank you. You need to make that bigger. We're seeing a lot of anxiety and relief behaviors. We're seeing not only the cutting that we often see, the largest increase in concerns, and I know Reed Plimpton's going to be doing a session this afternoon on the Maine Integrated Youth Health Survey, so talking more about this is the incident, reported incidents of vaping in young children. Pretty significant. But our little ones, what are our little ones doing when they're feeling anxious and confused and concerned? Chewing. Chewing on themselves, chewing on their clothing, picking at themselves, pulling their hair out. We're seeing a lot more of these behaviors with little kids. So you may be familiar with the CAMI study. This is done every 3 years, and it's a telephone survey done across the country with parents. And they look at ACEs. And one of the things that for us was pretty profound from 2014 to 2017, when this study was repeated, was Maine moved to now be one of 12 states with the highest ACE scores in the country for kids birth to 17. Highest ACE scores in the country. And we know what happens with these kids. They're more frequently expelled or excluded from school. They have a lot more illness and sickness. They have problems with self-regulation and creating relationships, positive peer and adult relationships. So I want to, how many of you know about the My House, the Maine Integrated Youth Health Survey? More than I thought, that's good. So these data we use a lot, especially with schools and community groups. And I'm just going to highlight a couple. So it looks at a whole lot of areas of health and well-being. So it asks kids if they wear their helmets when they ride their bikes. It looks at nutrition, mental health, sexual activity, bullying. Do they feel safe? Do they feel safe at home? Do they feel safe at school? And this year, 2017, was the first time that they asked any ACEs questions. And what happened was we used two proxy questions for sexual assault and exposure to violence, and there was nothing asked about either substance use disorder or poverty. So just keep that in your head as we talk about this. The kids were asked a series of questions that were extracted from both the briefs as well as the ACEs study. So looking at family divorce or parent death, incarceration, mental illness, emotional abuse, or physical abuse. And what we found was out of all of the high school students that completed this section of the survey, that about a quarter of our kids, of these eight questions that were asked, about a quarter of our kids are looking at three or more of these eight, which is the same thing if you know the ACEs study. It's the statistical equality with 4 out of 10 in the ACEs study. And if you pack on poverty and substance use disorder, I live in Piscataquis County, poorest county in the state. So when you look at the county, these data by county, you'll see Waldo County, Piscataquis, and then Washington is the top three counties. But regardless of which county you're in, this is a serious problem for our state, regardless of where you live. I provided some data. These are the data. I don't know why these slides are all bouncy, but these are the data by county. And it'll show you the range of kids and then by gender. And the thing I want you to notice about these data and the reason that we put these in was to really encourage you to start looking at them within your own backyard and within your own patient population. There's something going on with our young women. They are demonstrating statistically significant higher scores, not only in ACEs, but in bullying, depression, suicidal ideation. Okay. Got it. When we look at sexuality, our LGBT kids, we're seeing higher ACE scores with kids who are identifying as LGBTQ. When we look at three or more ACEs by sexuality, by region, by transgender, we see, again, higher scores, male and female. Kids of color have higher ACE scores than Caucasian kids. And we can see this replicated here. So when we look at the social determinants of health, bullying, how many kids have been bullied on school property? Again, girls more frequently than boys. Electronic bullying, significant. I was at a high school the other day, and they had done some health classes with their junior level students, separated the girls from the boys. Out of 9 girls in one of the classes, 7 of the girls had been exposed to male genitalia on their cell phones within the prior month. The second class, it was 5 out of 6. None of these kids told anybody. Why? Because they didn't want to lose their phones. They didn't want to lose their phones. Suicidal ideation, again, girls, more significantly than boys. Were you ever so sad, helpless, hopeless for every day for more than 2 weeks in a row? Again, girls higher than boys. So we like to talk about ACEs a lot. We talk about these data a lot with community groups and with schools and with practices because we're seeing the impacts of this, both from a health and well-being perspective as well as an economic and community health perspective as well. And a lot of what kids are doing are ways to cope with the pain that they're feeling. And exactly what Steve was talking about. It's a terrible thing when you are a grand family and you've got in between you and your grandchild an adult child who is challenging you just as well. So we're really looking, this is my I'm gonna stop with this slide in the interest of time, but I was doing a presentation a while ago and there was a gentleman, older gentleman in the group, and he raised his hand about 15 minutes into the conversation and he said, why don't we just tell these kids to suck it up? Because isn't that what people said to us? This is life and the sooner you get used to it, the better off you're gonna be. And I was just transitioning to this slide and I said, that's such a good observation, sir. We are sucking it up really good, aren't we? We're sucking it up so good that we have IV drug use with people who have unresolved trauma is at an all-time high. Domestic violence is at an all-time high. Alcoholism at an all-time high. So I really want to encourage you to use these data to become involved in your community groups, to talk about what's going on. One of the most important questions in the back of the My House is the question that kids ask and answer. And I'll ask you to look at these data in the presentation. In my community, I feel like I matter to people. Mattering, belonging, is a principal foundation of resilience. And we've been able to move that needle together as a state from 40% in 2009 to almost 60% in 2017. So it's because of people like you. So thank you very much. Read the rest.
That was great. That was great.
All right. Well, thank you both, and thank you for staying on time. I know you both could probably go on forever about these topics because you have a lot of experience and information to share. So there are additional slides which are posted online, too. So if you ever, want to go back through later, some references and slides will be posted online. So right now we're going to split up into our afternoon breakout sessions. So the Calm Collaborative will stay in here again. And then if you are going to the My House 2017 data presented with analysis, you'll be back in the carriage house that's across the road. So again, just Calm in here. And then we'll get back, there'll be a break after this next session. And at break, make sure you finish your bingo cards if you want to win a prize. Thank you, everyone.